Before we begin this week, I just want to send a shout out to all of our veterans who are currently back home enjoying time with their family after they've served in combat, and to those who made the ultimate sacrifice and unfortunately did not come home. Thank you for your service. We are observing Veterans Day this weekend. It's being observed on Friday because that's the nearest calendar, you know, nearest weekday. That's kind of how it goes. Sometimes if it's on the Sunday, it goes on the Monday. You know, for certain services and certain employees who may be off to observe the holiday and to honor our veterans. So it's on Friday, but the actual day is on the 11th, which is Saturday. So whether you're listening to this on Friday or Saturday or whichever day you're looking to observe this, we want to send a special shout out to our veterans because they are what makes the American dream possible and to make our everyday lives possible. Whether it is in combat, whether it was in an act of war, maybe you were in World War II, if you're still around, which if you are, God bless you. Maybe it was Vietnam. Maybe it was not even combat. Maybe you were just deployed somewhere, being stationed somewhere across the globe just to make sure that Americans are safe. We thank you for your service and everything that you've done. You are tremendous and you will never be forgotten. So thank you. And to those of you who are listening out there, if you see a veteran this weekend, maybe go up to them, shake their hand, thank them for their service. Because without them, we wouldn't be able to have the conversation we are right now. They are what are keeping America a free country and our right to exist and democracy. Now, democracy, that's something we've been talking a lot about this week. It was Election Day. Now, Election Day has come and gone, but we're still talking about it. Republicans didn't do as well as expected. That's kind of the big thing that everybody is talking about here. Now, the Democrats, you know, with an unpopular president and obviously polling that wasn't looking too great for the president going into this thing, with the New York Times Siena poll showing that former President Trump is beating him in 5 out of 6 battleground states. And then the CNN poll that came out shortly before the election showed that as well. So there was a lot of optimism on the GOP side that it was just going to happen. But the Democrats managed to prevail on the down ballot and ended up picking up a lot of seats in state legislatures, including ours, and also won the governor's mansion in Kentucky once again. So the Democrats had their ground game for sure. But important to know here, the Republicans did pick up a city council seat in the Bronx for the first time in decades. And they also did well out in Long Island. But besides from that, and Mississippi, obviously, and then a few things around New Jersey, Somerville, Brian Gallagher, he flipped that mayoral seat from blue to red in a heavily Democratic area. Sayreville, Kenny O'Brien, that's a swing area. He's a former mayor of the town. He decided not to run for re-election last time. Then the Democrats won, and he came back. He crushed it. He got about a 20-point victory, depending on where the final numbers come down with the mail-in votes and when it's all tabulated. But essentially, double-digit lead for O'Brien. And also, Sayreville Republicans gained control of the entire council. So there's really no Democrats left on the local level in Sayreville. And also in Westfield, Republicans did well too. Branchburg, a lot of Central Jersey, Summit. So Republicans did have some wins. But the conversation is largely surrounding what they didn't win. That they thought Daniel Cameron was going to be their knight in shining armor in Kentucky. And that he was going to win. He's the attorney general there. But Republicans did win Well, also, most of those races statewide in Kentucky, they just didn't get the governor's race. But regardless, this anger was felt at the third GOP presidential debate, where Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy commented on the election results. They weren't too happy about it. Well, Ramaswamy took it a step further, calling for RNC chair Ronna McDaniel to resign. Now, that's up some fireworks, as you can imagine, as a lot of people weren't expecting that. And NBC cameras caught the two of them getting into a heated exchange afterwards. So after the debate, the two of them went up to each other. And based on the reporting, we can kind of gather, we don't have the solidified details. Of course, we're trying to dig into that. That essentially it was about this topic. That, you know, it ain't good luck because the RNC are the ones hosting the debate. And Ramaswamy basically bashed the host. It's like, thanks for inviting me, but by the way, you suck. And with McDaniel, you know, she's got to walk a fine line too. Because remember, she had a contentious re-election bid to get that RNC chair position again. Although she had Trump's backing, a lot of people, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, said, maybe it's time for someone else like Harmy Dillon, who is her primary opponent there in that race. So she won. She's not expecting to run for re-election again in 2024. It's an every two-year thing. But if she wants to hold on to the power that she has, she's got to keep everybody happy, including this anti-establishment crowd within the Republican Party. Don't really like her at this moment. So she's got a balancing act she's going to play. But she's still defending herself. And she went on CNN afterwards, where she basically said that Republican infighting isn't helpful and that the RNC isn't directly involved with state and local elections. She said they focus on the president, the House, and the Senate. That's their main goal. But they'll help when it's, you know, when it comes about. But the important thing to note about McDaniel, there's a little behind the scenes knowledge here when it comes to this. McDaniel did also reportedly approach Virginia Republicans about possibly helping him out with their efforts to gain a majority in the state house. And from what we can gather, the Virginia governor, Republican Glenn Youngkin, said, nah, we don't need it, but thanks, Ronna, anyways. And she also went to criticize how she believes abortion was the issue and that Republicans running scared of it aren't really doing themselves any favors. She's claiming the ones who ran right into it are the ones who ended up being victorious. We'll have to look at the exit polling and see if the chairwoman is correct on that and how all this plays out. But getting back to the debate here, Ramaswamy also criticized McDaniel's choice of NBC as the host of the debate, saying Tucker Carlson, Elon Musk, or Joe Rogan should be the ones moderating because they know more of what conservatives care about than the people at NBC. And again, keep this in mind, he was saying this right to the moderator's face. And McDaniel responded to that criticism by saying the GOP can't be in an echo chamber. And if they want to expand the party and appeal to independents, then Republicans need to go to other media outlets other than conservative ones. So that was her response to that. And on top of that, Ramaswamy went even further into this. If you believe it, Vivek went all in on this. He then went and made a direct criticism to the moderator, Kristen Welker, who's the new host of Meet the Press. He started pressing her on how the network covered the investigation into possible ties, or alleged ties, I should say, at this point, between the Trump campaign and Russia. He asked her, do you believe that the reporting was false? Did you guys make mistakes? She didn't answer that question, but it still got him a lot of buzz, and obviously people questioning, why are you attacking the moderator when you're at the debate to participate in and be answer the questions? Now, Ronna McDaniel did comment on that. She said, if you can't handle tough questions, then you probably shouldn't be running for president. Keep in mind, this is a public spat going on between McDaniel. She's trying to avoid it, but she's as you heard from the abortion comments, she's someone who believes you got to put up a defense to everything. And that's what she's trying to do with Ramaswamy. She doesn't want the credibility of the RNC going down. So she's got to play ball, but at the same time, she can't piss him off either. She's got to try and stay neutral, even though she is a kind of a Trump appointee, but you know, she's also the niece of Mitt Romney. So she's got she's got to walk a very fine tightrope line here. A very big balancing act that McDaniel's trying to pull together here to keep everybody happy. With all that in mind, the GOP debate did have some drama behind the scenes surrounding that, and things got a little personal for some of the candidates as well, because this wasn't the only fight that Vivek picked. He also got into it with Nikki Haley. Now, you may remember in the last debate, you know, Haley said that whenever she hears Ramaswamy talk, she feels like she's getting dumber and dumber. And then when they were talking about China, she accused him of using TikTok to reach out to his voters. And Ramaswamy said, well, that's the way you expand the voter base. That's where the younger people are. If you want younger voters, you got to go there. And, you know, if you want to just keep talking to Republicans all the time, you're not going to be able to do that. If you're not on TikTok, you got to go there. That's where the other voters are. Well, Haley didn't really like that answer at the time. So then Vivek remembered that. And now part two, he calls out her daughter for using it. Basically saying, well, you know, Governor Haley, you're criticizing me for using it. Well, maybe you need to go look at your own family first. Maybe you should go talk to your daughter about why she's using TikTok. Well, that enraged Nikki Haley there. She went all mother bear on that one. She called him scum for that and to keep her family out of it. And important to note, from what we could see from the cameras after the debate, they did not shake hands. You know, sometimes these things can get very ugly, these debates. But at the end of the day, the candidates can still shake their hand up. She did not shake his hand. She looked visibly disgusted by what Ramaswamy was saying. And Ramaswamy, as I say, he's got his own problems. He had his Ronna McDaniel, who he's got to deal with. So she wasn't really the priority on that. By the end of the debate, he had some other things he had to do, as well as controversy about him calling Zelensky a Nazi, the Ukrainian president, and now the campaign's going back on that, saying, no, he didn't really do that. So there certainly was no shortage of drama when it came to that. And then also, Haley and DeSantis went back and forth in their own ways, Haley accusing DeSantis of being against fracking, claiming that he didn't want to do any of it in Florida. And DeSantis' defense was like, well, I'm not fracking in the Everglades because that's an environmental problem. And then DeSantis saying that she is not tough on China because she let China buy land in South Carolina. So they had their little exchange because, you know, they got to try and knock each other out. That's the name of the game, right? She's trying to get to second place now. DeSantis is trying to hold on and go after the big fish, former President Trump. So they're now jockeying for second, while everybody else is just trying to literally stay on the debate stage, because Doug Burgum, who was in the last debate, didn't make this debate. And it's somewhat unclear. And also, former Vice President Mike Pence didn't make it either. He had to drop out because he wasn't able to make it happen for him. So there really is a question of who's getting voted off the island. A little aside from the last debate where, you know, the moderators asked that. And then Sanders was like, oh, no, we're not going to devote someone off the island. But, of course, Chris Christie already wrote something down. And we still don't know what it is, but maybe we'll find out one day. So certainly look into there. But in case you're wondering about the next debate, yeah, they already hit the ground running on that. The next morning after this one, they announced that the next GOP presidential debate is going to be hosted by News Nation, a fairly new cable news channel that tries to be more of a centrist news channel, kind of like what we do here. They try to be in the middle. They don't want to be a little too far to the right or the left. They try to keep it center-based and just tell the facts the way they are. But the interesting choice is in the moderators there. They are bringing in Megyn Kelly, the SiriusXM host and popular conservative podcast host. She's coming in to do this. Then they got their own anchor, Elizabeth Vargas, who I believe hosts the 6 p.m. hour. Yeah, she anchors that. And then they have the Washington Free Beacon's reporter, Elena Johnson. So the Washington Free Beacon, that's kind of a little bit of an offbeat conservative media website where they kind of put out stories and stuff like that, which is kind of ironic because, you know, this is kind of what Ramaswamy was rambling against the night before. And then surely enough, now they're going AWOL. They're getting rid of the so-called establishment media. So now they're going to go to News Nation. So that's going to be held on December 6th. So about a month from now, because originally we weren't sure whether there was going to be another debate before the primaries. And who knows? The way the scheduling works, maybe they'll try and slip another one in early January. Because this one is not going to be in Iowa, not New Hampshire, not even South Carolina. It's going to be in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So a lot of them so far have had a significance of why they're put in a certain place. Like Milwaukee, that's a swing state. And also where the RNC is holding its convention next year. That's usually the tradition. They host the first debate in the same city they're going to host the convention. That makes sense. Then they were hosting the other one in California because that's where the Reagan Library is. So they hosted it there. So we're going to have to see what the one in Alabama is going to look like. And if maybe they slip one in January, is it going to be in Iowa? Is it going to be in New Hampshire? And are there even going to be enough candidates who qualify for the debate? Because now the threshold's going up too. Remember that. A lot to watch there. But here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. Well, this week we had our annual elections, except this time they were more localized elections, but they were nationwide. And some people were picking up some trends. For the large part, Democrats had a lot of big wins in ways some people weren't expecting. Just look at the Kentucky's governor's race. Yes, Beshear is pretty popular over in Kentucky, and he already won last time and was running for re-election and was considered a rising star in the Democratic Party. He won there against a rising star on the other side of the aisle, Daniel Cameron, and some people were shocked by the way that margin's looking out. So we have that. The Democrats won. Then there was the Ohio abortion referendum. Democrats won that around 10 percentage points in a state that's been going a little more towards the Republican direction. So that shocked some people in a way. But then also, you had the Virginia state legislative races, similar to what we have going on in our state, where they had to pick people in their House of Delegates and their state Senate. Republicans were hoping to flip the whole chamber that way, especially the Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, who flipped that governor's seat red for the first time in a while. That didn't really work out. But then there were some bright spots for Republicans, and that is in Mississippi. This is where Tate Reeves, you know, not exactly the most popular guy in the whole world, he was running against a second cousin of Elvis Presley, the rock star. That's right, the hound dog guy. Brandon Presley. Yeah, it was kind of close, but Reeves still pulled it off. And that was giving Republicans some hope, a little bit of sigh of relief, because our own governor, Phil Murphy, who is the head of the National Democratic Governors Association, they were looking to pick that up. He thought it was going to be a sleeper race. That didn't end up. But of course, we have our own races here in New Jersey, where there are some Republicans who are a little shocked at what happened. And that would be the fact that Republicans, they thought they were going to go into this thing and gain a ton of seats, or at the very least pick up a few. Well, it actually did the opposite. In the Senate, it was a net zero because Trucker, Ed Durr, who beat former Senate President Steve Sweeney in the 3rd District 2 years ago, he lost. And then they picked up a seat in the 12th District, which is around the Old Bridge area, where that Republican became a Democrat. And Republicans obviously picked that up. Old Bridge Mayor Owen Henry there picked that up. So there, and then there were some, there were 5 seats in the Assembly where Republicans lost there as well. So we're going to break all this down here. And joining us to do that is
New Jersey Globe editor David Wildstein and Jersey First TV's Real Talk with Fernando Uribe host, Dr. Fernando Uribe. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Joey.
David, going into this night, as I said, we were kind of expecting a little bit of a different kind of trend here. You know, we know New Jersey, a blue state, obviously, but we thought given the momentum, given this new map that was formed, giving the Republicans a narrow shot to take the majority in one or both chambers, at the very least, maybe there'd be some pickups. We're trying to figure out where would the Republicans have the best shot, but it ended up being the fact that the Democrats flipped 5 seats in the state legislature. What happened here?
Well, I think the map was fair. This was the deal map. This was a map that was adopted with Democrats and Republicans agreeing on boundaries that would give both parties a path to control of the legislature. Republicans much, much more difficult because they were already behind, but in the perfect world there would have been. I don't think the failure's in the maps. I don't think it's on the lines. I think what you're seeing is some failures on candidate recruitment. Republicans didn't get their A-list candidates in a lot of the potentially competitive districts. They were horrible at raising money. That money did not flow in the way, you know, it was. And I'm old, so I've been through this, and, you know, and I ran a campaign in the 1980s that flipped control of the legislature, and you know, money is key to these things. And then the messaging, it looks like some of their messaging was off. But even if it wasn't, even if the messaging was perfect, you got to have a good candidate to present to the voters, and you've got to have the money for that candidate to put their message out. I think this was, in retrospect, I was shocked. I not shocked about the outcome of any particular race, but shocked by the margins of victories by Democratic candidates in targeted districts, and shocked that Republicans couldn't catch a break in New Jersey.
Fernando, you interviewed a lot of these candidates who were on the ballot this year. Depending on which district, it didn't really matter. You got people Republicans who were running on the liberal districts. Mm-hmm. Then you had some Democratic candidates. You also had some swing district candidates on. You had people in South Jersey. You kind of have a feel of what these candidates were thinking about, what the messaging was like. Are you surprised by these results?
I'm a little surprised, but I do want to echo something that David said. And I think a big dynamic here, and, you know, I've had a full 24 hours to process this. And, you know, I was a little emotional last night. I'm a little more objective here. And it's almost like how I look at calling into sports talk radio shows. I'm a big Cowboy fan, so I'm already, like, used to misery. I'm already used to being disappointed on multiple levels. But last night was, like, a different level because I interviewed a lot of different Senate candidates and Assembly candidates all throughout the state. And David brought up a good point about not raising money. And I was a little emotional last night about crucifying Bob Hugin, the chair of the NJGOP, and sort of the apparatus. And, you know, 24 hours later, I'm going to dial it down a little bit. I'm still angry because I think that the NJGOP as an institution didn't do enough to help candidates. Case in point, I interviewed Micheline Atea. She was a Senate candidate in District 38. And I'm just looking at some numbers she preliminary from the Bergen County Division of Elections. And again, this may not be the most accurate, but right now I looked at a margin of 3%. I can tell you, I know for a fact that NJGOP barely put any money, if not at all, into that race. And that was a winnable district. And it just is a reinforcement where I think that while it's easy to pile on Bob Hugin today, if you're a conservative like me and Republicans statewide, I think some vitriol has to be levied on the county committees because they either didn't vet candidates correctly, like to David's point, or vetted them enough, or get the best people out there. I interviewed a lot of good candidates. I interviewed Chris Ariyama in Bergen County as well. Michelina Tay, as I just mentioned. I interviewed a lot of other. I interviewed Ed Durr on Monday night, for God's sakes, the night before the election. And I seriously thought that, hey, that he was going to win. I just think it's an indictment about the NJGOP, how they don't raise money enough, how they don't embrace vote by mail, how they don't embrace early voting. And the messaging, I think, with some candidates also, I think, was a little suspect. Roll that all together into one gumbo, and we got what we got on Tuesday night.
David, I want to go to something Fernando just said. Vote by mail and early voting. This has been something Republicans have been talking about and talking about for the last 3 years now, where at first they were kind of skeptical. They were like, nah, we don't want to do that. Let's just wait for the election. Let's wait for the election. Our voters are going to come. They're going to come. And it seemed like time and time again, that wasn't really happening. And then the party leaders were like, all right, we got to try and do something here. I asked this question to just about every Republican candidate who came on who was running this year. Are you using these methods? They said yes. Is there still a fault here? Are Republicans just need to do a better job at vote by mail and getting their voters out early?
Republicans are going to continue to get their ass kicked if they don't get with the vote by mail and early voting program. And, you know, look, numbers don't lie. And we were all looking at these numbers on a daily basis. The number of ballots, vote by mail ballots, requested by Democrats was about 65% of the total electorate. The Republicans were about 20%. The imbalance was extraordinary. Now, I'll give you an example in the fourth legislative district, which was supposed to be the battleground. It was drawn to probably give the Republicans a little bit of an edge, and this was a Democratic seat, full Democratic delegation for the last two decades. The district got much better, but Democrats understood, well, you know, if the playing field's no good, how do we fix it? How do we improve our chances? So they went through a really strong process of reaching out to Democrats that were unlikely to vote in an off year election like 2023, when the legislature heads the ballot, there's no statewide candidate. About a third of the Democratic vote by mail ballots cast in the fourth district were from Democrats that probably would not have voted otherwise. And that's what's happening. They made their own luck because they were smart. And when whether you like vote by mail or you don't like vote by mail, whether you think early voting is a good idea or a bad idea, bottom line is that's how it is. Those are the rules, and that's how it works. And you can't let one side get an advantage over you because you're standing there on principle and saying, I don't like the process. So Democrats are making their own luck. They're banking more votes, and the Republicans are just sort of walking around humming and saying, yeah, we'll get our votes out on election day. And guess what? In a lot of these districts where they got their clocks cleaned, it's because they didn't get the vote on an election day. They had an opportunity to do vote by mail. They had 9 days of early voting. They waited. They put all their eggs in one basket, and the electorate disappointed them.
Fernando, I want to talk specifically about some of these margins that may cast a little bit of a light of what David is talking about. In the 11th district, for example, Monmouth County district, this has been seen as a swing district, although the map kind of made it a little better for Democrats. And State Senator Vinco Powell was in the political fight of his political life here, essentially, that if he didn't win this election, it may have been a career ender for him. Well, not only did he win, he crushed the competition there by about 20 points, which is something we haven't seen in that district, really. And his run, and then also... the two Republican assemblywomen who were also representing that district, they got knocked out. What can we say about this district? Is this something that Republicans could really get back, or is this something that
you know, Democrats are going to have a lock on, and that's the end of it.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that Vin Gopal is a expert campaigner. He's a guy who I've interviewed multiple times on my show, which you can check out on Monday nights, by the way, folks, at 6 p.m. Eastern time on Jersey First. But, you know, he comes across as sort of a moderate Democrat. And I know that I think a lot of conservatives went after him, especially with the, you know, the sex ed curriculum and maybe not standing up to the governor more about the COVID policies that we all know now were not good for the state. I think that he was able to resonate with a lot of independents. I think the Republican Assembly incumbents just didn't run a good campaign. I think they were all over the place. Again, you know, to David's point, and he stresses this a lot when he does his show with Joey Fox and the great people at you know, at the New Jersey Globe. And it just it's interesting to me where Democrats, again, still have that registration advantage. And I think also they've just been better at the messaging where for the life of me, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into the more local races where, you know, Board of Ed races, I think, were centered more about around the culture wars and parental rights. I think at the state level, again, Republicans did an atrocious job highlighting the obvious that, you know, New Jersey continues to become unaffordable. We have tens of thousands of people leaving New York and New Jersey collectively to better run states. And, you know, it's mind-boggling to me that the NJGOP and the county committees could not develop a better message. You know, maybe the messengers weren't great, and I know I might get in trouble for saying this out loud, but someone who took a humongous L on Tuesday night was Jack Cittarelli, the presumptive, you know, Republican candidate for governor in 2025. He had a horrible Tuesday. Bob Hugin had a horrible Tuesday, you know, and I think it's a reflection of just not being more proactive and more aggressive, trying to raise money, have a better message. Again, the state's in disarray. We're getting taxed to death. We're getting suffocated with, you know, the gas tax. The budget's out of control, but yet Republicans can't hammer this home. It's really frustrating for me as a fiscal conservative who is, I'm the only journalist really hammering this home every week on a weekly show. So it's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, and Joey, I should also point out in this district, first of all, Gopal ran a great campaign, and you can't take that away from him.
Yes, he did.
He knew the district that he was in. He knew, you know, he knew what he had to do, what those goals were to hit. And the Republicans, you know, I hate to kick somebody when they're down, especially the day after an election, because, you know, I've run for office and I remember what it was. You know, I mean, thank God I won, but I was, you know, tired. I just wanted it to be over. So, you know, I hate to say it, but the Republicans didn't get their best candidate there. Tom Arnone, county commissioner, you know, would have been a great candidate. Christine Hanlon, the county clerk, one of the two assemblywomen that have been in the legislature, could have run. But instead, they find this guy, Steve Denestrian. Maybe he's a nice guy, but he didn't know how to do this. And you know, he would give interviews and people would ask him, well, where are you on abortion? And he wouldn't say. And where are you on this? And he wouldn't say. And he was just, I don't think he connected with people. This is an example of if they had gotten the top tier recruit, it might have been different. But they, you know, these were the cards that were dealt, and Gopal took advantage of every opportunity there. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's nothing. You know, there's nothing that replaces a well-oiled campaign.
Joey, if I can just jump on that point, David said it beautifully. I think that, again, credit to Vin Gopal, great campaigner, great team he has around him, obviously getting the governor to go into that district a couple of times to campaign for him, I think helps greatly, right? I mean, resonates with the base. But I think, again, it's a testament to what David said. It's not running the best candidates. And I think now, I think there needs to be a come to Jesus moment here in these next few days. Like, it's interesting, the League of Municipalities is next week in Atlantic City. I look forward to going to it. And I know that the South Jersey GOP or the NJGOP as a whole have one of their parties there. I can't imagine how dead that's going to be next week. It's going to seem like a funeral there, because I think a lot of people were expecting some gains on last night, and it didn't happen. Again, they lost the Senate seat. They lost five assembly seats, I think, or not eight, maybe. I don't remember exactly, so you'll have to correct me. But the bottom line is that I think this is where the Republican Party in New Jersey needs to sit down and do a serious reboot. Whoever these operatives are that are working, and again, no disrespect to Chris Russell. I like Chris. I've interviewed Chris multiple times. He's a nice guy. I'm not trying to pile on him, to add to David's point.
And hugely talented.
But I think it maybe it's time to start looking outside of New Jersey. Start looking at some operatives out of New York or D.C. I know it's costly, but if you want to win elections, you have to kind of spend money. And I just don't think that, again, you know, I was just so surprised at some of these margins last night. And again, going into next year and going into 2025, I just think the Republican Party in New Jersey is in serious trouble. To David's point, the vote by mail, the early voting, they still have not embraced it the way Democrats do. I mean, it's lock, step, and barrel with this team. And I think that's why they win elections statewide, and then they keep winning elections, because they've embraced a mechanism that isn't going anywhere, and they've embraced a mechanism that we know puts them in a considerable advantage 10 days before Election Day. And Republicans are going to be in the short end of the stick if they don't get their act together.
David, to Fernando's point here, South Jersey was supposed to be the bastion of the future of the Republican Party, that essentially they were supposed to be building this coalition down there where the Democrats, who were blue collar, traditionally voted for, you know, JFK and all these Democratic politicians, that to the point now where the party's kind of moved away from them. So they were kind of becoming more Trump Republicans, but they lost down there. You had Ed Durr. He lost to a former assemblyman. He got that. John Buccicelli, he won there. The whole delegation got wiped out. And then in a district where actually, where vote by mail, the Republicans had a slight edge going into that, they could only get one guy on the assembly line, on the assembly side of this, actually over the finish line. Because in that Lakewood-based district in the 30th, solidly Republican, that's where an Orthodox Jewish leader actually was able to win there. Where does
that'll be an asterisk in the history books forever, because the 30th district, the Lakewood Wall Howell district, on paper it is arguably the most Republican district in New Jersey, but the Lakewood Orthodox Jewish community is well organized, and they decided it late that, you know, Rabbi Avi Schnall didn't get into the race until the end of August. They decided, well, we have a senator from Lakewood, Bob Singer. He's a Republican. He's in that caucus. And so wouldn't it help us if we had somebody else who was in the majority caucus on the Democratic side, so that we're represented from both ends? The numbers there were, I mean, off the charts crazy. It's almost like make-believe land. I'll give you the highlight, which is there were 37,000 voters in Lakewood in this district who voted in the 2020 presidential race. That's the whole district. That's the biggest turnout year by far. People vote in presidential years. This is the low end of the turnout. And they had 45,000 people turn out and vote. Avi Schnall won Lakewood by 18,000 votes. That's crazy. And they voted, and the voters came out and they said, well, we're going to vote for Bob Singer, Republican senator, Sean Keene, Republican assemblyman, but vote for Schnall instead of Ned Thompson. And this was just orchestrated perfectly. This is a community that wanted representation. But that's an outlier. It's just an outlier. It's not just the right candidate, but it's a community that's organized. You know, the more, you know, the crazier thing was just in District 4, where, you know, and where they couldn't pick up a seat. Or, you know, you go up north, you go to Andrew Zwicker, and you go to Joe Lagana, Vin Gopal. They couldn't take anybody out. They couldn't lay a glove on anybody. And, you know, you can't start out in the minority and win no races and then lose ground without it, you know, without somebody being held accountable. I don't know who that's going to be. But, you know, I don't mean to ramble. I apologize. But I'll say one last thing. You know, all three of us have a lot of respect for history and how it affects times. And when you go back and you look at second term governors in their sixth year in office, they always lose seats. The governor's party always lose seats. I can take you back to 1949 with the adoption of the new constitution. That is the way it has been. And Phil Murphy, who almost lost his own election 2 years ago, he's the guy who has broken that trend. And you know, you have to look at it. First of all, you've got to give the governor props for that because that's changing history. But there's a reason that's happened. And part of it is his party was organized. And part of it was, it's almost this perfect storm, right? The Democrats were organized and the Republicans blew it. And all of a sudden, what you're going to have is 100 years from now, people like us are going to look through the records. They're going to look at that Fitzgerald's manual red book and they're going to go, wow, what happened in 2023? How did this Murphy guy buck the trend? And I think that's, you know, that's a big deal here. That's really something that everybody's got to take a look at.
I completely agree with David, Joey. I mean, I think that, you know, and I criticize the governor all the time. I call him the emperor, for God's sakes, every week on my show. But I have to be fair to Phil. And he has found a way to be resilient. He has found a way. And again, credit to Leroy Jones, the state chair. I think he's rolled up his sleeves. He's put in the work. He's been on the county committees and the county chairs to be organized. And it shows with, you know, a good get out the vote mechanism. I mean, no one's better than get out the vote than my mayor and state senator, Brian Stack. I mean, it's such a cheap plug here on the show today, but you know, my man right there, Brian Stack. But, you know, Leroy Jones has worked closely with the governor to be organized. And it's just funny to me where we know that there are certain policies that Phil Murphy has embraced that in the long term are going to be harmful to us. For whatever reason, again, the messaging, whether it was gas stoves, whether it's electric cars, we all know that these are policies that are going to be long after he's gone, thankfully. These are policies we might have to deal with. And again, Republicans missed the boat on messaging. You know, they had the ball at the goal line and they either fumbled it or got stopped on fourth down. And that's what happened last night. I think that's the easiest sports analogy I can think of where they had it. And they had the opportunity to make some gains. And again, I think this doesn't bode well for 2025. I think when, you know, with Phil Murphy's term thankfully coming to an end, we're going to see whether it's Stephen Fulop, the mayor nearby in Jersey City, whether it's maybe U.S. Representatives Gottheimer and Sherrill collectively, maybe it's Newark Mayor Ross Bragg. We're going to see. But Democrats are well organized. They have the wind to their back now. And Republicans have a lot of work to do. And I'll even say this. And this might get me in trouble, but a guy that went under the radar last night and a guy that, you know, David reported on him promptly, you know, let's give some flowers to Mike Testa. And this is a guy, the Cumberland County chair, who very well organized in South Jersey, you know, got a lot of things to flip his way. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to be mean. I don't want to pile on, but if the NJGOP wants to do a hard reboot and look in the mirror about going a different direction, I would say Mike Testa should be the state GOP chair coming up soon. He gets it at a local level. He's organized, and that's a guy that gets it. Now, does Mike Testa resonate in Central and North Jersey? Well, I don't know. We'll see. But right now, what the NJGOP is doing is not enough, and it shows.
And, Joey, you know, one of the things that the parties both got to do, but especially Republicans, we saw it this year, they've got to vet their candidates more carefully. They've got to not put people up. The Democrats will look at it and, you know, and just sort of lick their lips and say, wow, this one's going to be easy. This is going to be a layup. There was one candidate in a district that maybe had an outside shot at being competitive. This guy, you know, the New Jersey Globe reported this extensively. He pled guilty to spreading feces on the door of a daycare center in South Bergen. And, you know, there are certain things. People, voters are forgiving. Voters will take a lot. But you can't spread feces on a nursery school door and expect to get elected to public office. And it just, you know, had it, I found it, you know, it's all public record. You go online. It's never been easier to vet somebody. And these parties allow flawed candidates to put their name forward, and then the parties are stuck with them. And I think it's just crazy. They've got to do their job up front.
David's correct on that. I think, again, I don't want to pile on again. It seems like I'm being super malicious, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of dirty looks next week at the League of Municipalities from either Bob Hugin or a lot of NJGOP establishment people. I'm not trying to pile on here, but I think that there needs to be a serious reboot. I think that vetting candidates is so, so important. Again, being organized. And, you know, on a national level, I know that the national RNC chair took a beating as well, PR-wise, because of what happened with Ohio and in Kentucky and everything. I think it's unfortunate. It's an unfortunate mechanism here. It's trickling down, and I don't know what's going to happen. You know, yes, the NJGOP can probably brag about some gains at the local level, a lot of municipal council races that I'm happy about up here where I live in Hudson County nearby. Bergen County is a 10-minute drive for me. You know, Paramus, New Jersey, Bogota. I'm happy about these local races. These are people I interviewed. And I'm happy, you know, that I was able to give them some coverage, because God knows, and I'm going to use this line that I've had to borrow, and again, I'll give credit to David Wasson on this, the establishment media in New Jersey just doesn't want to cover. And, you know, I'm the only guy that really was talking to council candidates like that, and I'm happy that they won. But the NJGOP just cannot hang their hat on just Board of Ed races and council races. I mean, this legislative cycle was possibly to gain some seats. I mean, I know that Senator Buco was really overly optimistic about flipping the Senate and the Assembly as well. That was a little unrealistic. I thought they could make some gains, but this is just a catastrophe in its purest form of what happened last night.
Yeah, Republicans, yeah, they didn't really have a great night, but there were some bright spots for them and in some interesting places. And I want to start at the Assembly level. That is at the 2nd District. You know that well, David. That has been a swing district for a very long time. Split delegation, you name it.
60 years it's been a swing district.
Exactly. Both parties have been trying to get at, and Republicans, maybe they're closer to a lock because their Republicans won. State Senator Vince Palestina and his running mates, they won there despite this Democratic year. What can be made out of that? What are these candidates doing on that level that they're winning that these other candidates did not?
So the Democrats spent a lot of money trying to take Vince Palestina out. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars on television. He was on, you know, they were on Philly TV, which is very expensive. They were on cable. They had dark money groups, you know, which is, you know, we could do it. We could come back and do an entire thing on dark money groups and phantom candidates in this campaign. And I think that's going to be the story for the future. But Palestina, and this is his second stint in the legislature. He was, you know, he was a young assemblyman, left for a little while, came back for the Senate 2 years ago. He has figured out how to do this. And he has figured out how to build his own relationship with the voters. And you know, he's a Republican. Some Republicans will criticize him because he'll make a deal in the legislature, but he's a guy who's delivering for his district. He is a guy who is getting things from, you know, bills passed. He's bringing money home. And I think that's been his secret sauce. And great assembly candidates. Don Guardian used to be the mayor of Atlantic City. Until next year, the only openly gay member of the New Jersey legislature is a Republican from Atlantic City. So they had great candidates, great staff. They have not taken their foot off the gas until, you know, between the last election and Tuesday. And that's how you win. You get good candidates, you work it, you get people who understand how the legislature functions, And, you know, you stop all the whining and the belly aching and complaining. And instead you just go there and you say, I need to get some stuff done for my constituents. And they do it. And, you know, if they have, you know, these guys voted for the budget. Well, guess what? The ones who voted for the budget, the Republicans who voted for the budget won because they got to bring things home to their district. And, you know, it's nice to be able to say that you're effective for your constituents. Gopal did it. Zwicker did it. Lagana did it. The ones who won are the ones who said, you know what? I'm not going to just stand up there and vote no on everything. I'm going to make some accommodations on behalf of my constituents, bring some real money home. And look, at the end of the day, when you can run for office and say, you know, I've delivered some property tax relief because the state of New Jersey is sending money back to our district so that you don't have to pay a higher tax. That's just a very persuasive argument.
Yeah, I'll definitely bounce on that. Absolutely. I think when you show yourself to be flexible and you're entrenched and not just voting on everything and showing that you're bringing back to your district in terms of dollars, in terms of some form of aid, I think it's really a good reflection on you. If I could just add this, though, too, gentlemen, I mean, one race I was completely shocked about, and I knew it was going to be tight. I did not expect Ed Durr to lose last night. And I almost feel bad. It's like, man, did I jinx this guy or what on Monday night? I'm like, I felt good when I interviewed Ed, and I looked at his ticket, and I felt that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, they weren't working with the best apparatus in terms of raising money and everything else. Again, I don't want to pile on the NJGOP and say maybe they didn't help him enough, but the bottom line is that a lot of, you know, South Jersey Democrat money went into that race to take him out. And, you know, to David's point, again, the great report he does with the New Jersey Globe, but, you know, to think that Norcross and that entourage wasn't happy about last night's result and weren't involved in some way or raising money somehow, I think we have to be fooling ourselves. I think that it's all interrelated. That was one race that really surprised me. Just because I thought that Durr could squeak it out again like he did 2 years ago, but I didn't expect what happened last night to happen to Ed Durr. And it kind of makes you wonder, you know, where he goes from here. And then obviously, you know, does Steve Sweeney feel vindicated? Does Steve Sweeney want to jump back into something else? Who knows? But that was a race that really, really shocked me, gentlemen.
Yeah, we'll have to see where all of this goes. Very interesting results to dive into and to see how they impact in the elections to come. New Jersey Globe editor David Wildstein and Jersey First TV's Real Talk with Fernando Uribe host, Dr. Fernando Uribe. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Joey. Keep up the good work.
Well, that about does it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media. You can do that on X, formerly Twitter, at @block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, in case you don't know where to find us out there on the web, well, here's where you go. You go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You go there, you scroll down till you find In the Middle, you click on that, and all the episodes will be there. You'll have the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.